Session number 10044, Reel 8.
Mr. Powell, Reel 8.
In India, I belong to a different stage play, a different drama, a drama to which belonged Lord Lake, Arthur Wellesley. The soldiers of the first half of the 19th century, to a long history. But it was not an army of occupation in the middle of a campaign.
Coming on to the work that you did in intelligence, how much use did you find that the commanding officers made of the intelligence material that they were being fed with?
I would have thought that it was a vital part of the operational decisions. Of the operational decisions, certainly, which were taken in the attack by air and sea upon enemy communications. But I would say that the land battle, the conduct of the land battle, was influenced by well-founded appreciation of enemy capabilities and the enemy's supply situation. Indeed, it might well be that the timing of the Battle of El Alamein was influenced by a calculation of the potentialities of supply of Rommel's forces and of the stocks and reserves which they had in their control. A mention of that reminds me of another little event which links my Egyptian with my Indian experience. When Mercer Matru fell, I predicted that the Germans would reinstate the railway from Tobruk and that in a very short time they would have the railway working and rely upon it as their main line of supply for the forward troops. This was treated with some levity by those whom I so advised, until it turned out from the evidence from Ultra that in fact they had got the railway working and had imported diesel locomotives for the purpose. On my arrival in India, therefore, one of the first questions which I asked was about the Burma-Siam Railway. I said, I would assume the Burma-Siam Railway is complete. Complete, said my informants, not at all. It will be months yet. I said, what is your evidence for that? Oh, they said, we have evidence in the form of air reconnaissance. Can I see the evidence, please? And so they produced the evidence, and it showed the points which had been reached by in the construction of a railway at different dates. It is true that the last of those points was accurately pinpointed on the map. But it happened to be the point at which the railway went off the photograph. Having drawn attention to this logical mistake, I then said, it is my opinion that the railway has now reached Moulmein. I said that in the week in which the railway did reach Moulmein. I think Moulmein is the junction I want. So that's a little experience which shows how one's concentration upon a fairly technical form of supply and transport makes one's mind lively to possibilities in other theatres.
I presume that working in intelligence, you found that it was a very stimulating activity in the sense that the conclusions one drew were very quickly proved true or false. In contrast to a lot of academic work where very often that's not the case.
I wouldn't have phrased the question quite in that way. That's very much a politician's response. Because in dealing with intelligence material, the question you're asking is not what will happen, but what is now. and you test the reliability, you form your judgment about the material for its truthfulness now. The items add together of a picture which exists now. To draw deductions from that picture as to what will be the case next week or next month is not the business of military intelligence. It's true military intelligence can say those forces located there could move in X days with so many days' supplies behind them to point Y. No doubt. But then one is still describing what exists at the moment. One is not erecting hypotheses which fall to be tested by events so many weeks or months ahead. It is what forces, and forces of what capability, does the enemy have where? What is he doing now? What has he got now? Who is he? Where is he now? That is the business of intelligence.
But what happens in the immediate future can test the reliability of your estimates of the present situation.
I don't think the manner in which the reliability of sources is tested is quite by that sort of experimental verification backwards. I think it is the coherence of one piece of information with other pieces of information. If you have an intelligence report from Athens, for example, which is simply incompatible with the rest of what you know from other sources of what is happening in Athens, then you will be skeptical of that piece of information and of that source. You're not in the business of waiting for 2 or 3 months to find out what the situation is in Athens. So that the tests of veracity applied are non-experimental. They are tests for coherence and tests for consistency.
In the intelligence work that you were doing in North Africa, was the individual character and quality of each individual enemy division, did that come through in your intelligence estimates?
No, only insofar as the commander was concerned. But then, from the German point of view, North Africa was an exceptionally one-man show. And the personality of Rommel did have certain predictable aspects. In Burma, looking at the Japanese army, the predictability related not to individuals, but to the Japanese army. And certainly the Japanese army, as such, had certain habits, certain ways of proceeding, from which it didn't depart, and which it maintained with a rigidity which was almost incredible. For example, I recall the dispatch of a division into Burma. This must have been in 1944. And I remember predicting that that division will be broken up and we shall find bits of it in the Arakan, in Impal, and on other fronts. And that prediction was borne out. And I made the prediction simply because the curious thing is that when the Japanese sent in a reinforcement, instead of using it like the Germans to create a Schwerpunkt, they always, nearly always, seem to tear it up into elements which were often as small as a battalion or even a company. You could find companies from the same battalion at widely separate points. Now, these were characteristics of the Japanese and their behavior, which one gradually got to know. But they were extraordinarily predictable in their tactical behavior, in their movement behavior.
And you're going to relate that to Rommel in comparison?
No, I'm instituting a contrast between the national characteristics, the general characteristics of a Japanese, and the personal characteristics of an individual German commander.
What were his characteristics?
He had an exceptionally fine rapport with his troops, with his German troops. And he had an exceptional sense for the weaknesses of his opponents. I think probably if you had asked Rommel the question you've just asked me, he would probably have given you character sketches of several of the divisional and corps commanders by whom he was faced. But then I think that was one of Rommel's characteristics. He was very much, he engaged in hand-to-hand fighting, so to speak.
It's interesting that you should have made that point about Japanese rigidity, because some people have commented on what they see as the same characteristic on the part of the Germans.
Well, the Germans had it, but to a much less extent than the Japanese. The Germans were not so much predictable as disciplined. It was their discipline and their training which gave them a degree of predictability, which possibly they found we lacked.
It's interesting in this regard that the Germans never went in for units like the long-range desert group commando units, special forces and irregular forces.
I think this is more properly accounted for from the fact that the Germans were nearly always in a long-term position of superiority. After all, in North Africa, we were in a position of inferiority, numerical inferiority, even vis-a-vis the Italians, right from the beginning. Now, it's one of the characteristics of intelligence that it is the weapon of the aggressed. It is the weapon of the weaker side. And I had a striking verification of this in North Africa, because before we occupied Tobruk or Benghazi, I was literally the only person on the Allied side who knew where you could bring a ship alongside. I knew what the water was, what the draft was. I knew where the wrecks were. I knew the capacity of the shear legs. I knew what was needed to be known. The day after we occupied Benghazi, I could whistle for it. They were there, they could find out. Intelligence is the arm of the weak, the arm of those who are aggressed, who make up, to some extent, for the inferiority of the aggressed party by greater knowledge. And certainly in the Mediterranean, we made up for our weakness in the air, in Malta, to a staggering extent, by the superiority of our information. The aggressor is going to find out. He's going to be there. He conducts, as you might say, a reconnaissance in force.
Turning from intelligence matters to political matters in the war, have you any reflections on the effect of the Second World War on political attitudes of the serving British soldier, in particular as reflected in the 1945 election result?
I didn't have much political conversation, even with brother officers, let alone with other ranks, in the years that I was in Egypt or in India. I'm therefore speaking largely introspectively when I say that I think the soldiers, the soldiery, were aware that Churchill had been an important factor in their victory, and indeed he might have saved them from having been betrayed, but that only made it the more important that no one should in peacetime inherit authority from wartime achievement. There was, I think, a determination which the troops shared with the public at large, and a very English instinct to move against excess of authority and prestige. This made it possible to distinguish sharply between Winston Churchill, the man, and Winston Churchill, the conservative, or the leader of a conservative party, which he became in 1940.
Did the 45 election result take you by surprise personally?
No. Because I assumed that there would be a reaction against the war and all that, and against a conservative party riding into office on the back of military victory. I hope that isn't too drastic a metaphor.
Whilst you were in North Africa, did you come across the phenomenon which has become known as forces parliaments?
Tell me about it.
Which were kind of talking shops for troops to talk about politics and the future form that Britain was going to take politically and socially after the war.
I must have been quite completely insulated from all this. Perhaps I should add, going right back to my service in the ranks, that there was certainly no effort in those months, which is October 39 to January 40, I was about to use the word indoctrination, but that's a very strong word. I remember no effort to present the war case, the war aims, to the troops. What I do happen to remember was that the history of a regiment was taught to the men.
Did you attend such classes?
Yes, I distinctly remember classes in regimental history at the end of 1939, and regimental history based upon the battle honours of a regiment.
Were they well taught?
Better than not taught at all.
Do you think it helped to create an esprit de corps?
That would be putting it very high. I think it was the army treating its recruits, militiamen though they might be, wartime material they might be, as they would treat their recruits in time of peace. In that sense, they were being treated respectfully. We weren't just a number. It wasn't infantry regiment number 123. We weren't just a slice of population drafted into one place, which might just as well have been drafted into another place. To that extent, I repeat my expression, I think the recruits and those under training were treated with a degree of respect.
You said something earlier off the record about the war ending with a blank.
My war. Yes.
Can you explain what you meant by that exactly?
I do think it is extraordinary. I didn't think it so at the time, because as you go on living, the shape of events isn't clear to you. But in retrospect, I do find it very strange that out of a war which for me lasted from October 39 to February 46, two and a half years, yes? Is that right? I do find it strange in retrospect that out of a war which for me lasted 6.5 years, no less than 2.5 were spent in a way out of the war, concentrating upon scenes, upon a theatre, which was part of a general history of centuries and not directly involved in continuing warfare. And that my mind should have been able to concentrate so intensely upon India, its present and its future, while Europe was being pulverized. Japan, of course, was pulverized, but then the length of time involved in that between May and August 1945 was not really so significant. But I hadn't realized, I've lived so many years since the war, unconscious of how much of the war, how much of my war service, service which left a lasting imprint upon me, and indeed service which gave me my honorary rank of brigadier, was service outside the theatres of war.
I was interested earlier on when in the interview in what you said about the Second World War as in many senses a continuation of the First World War, because so many people have said to me that they regarded the Second World War as something very special and isolated from other wars.
Well, certainly to me the Second World War was seen coming for 5 years, and that in itself tends to indicate that I regarded it as in some sense a resumption where war left off in November 1918, and probably that was a point of view which was shared in Germany quite widely. But the picture of war which one had was the picture which had been so vivid in the years immediately after 1918, even to someone born in 1912. The picture of war was the picture of the trenches. It was the picture of war as it was in 1918. The picture of war as it was when an infantry officer's expectation of life was 3 weeks. And if that war was being resumed, if that war was being resumed against the same opponent, if it was being resumed on the same terrain in the continent of Europe, where else was one to look to imagine what it would be like? The phony war, well, that was phony. It was not a refutation of one's notions. It was simply a deferment of one's notions. That makes sense?
Yes, but many people have said, regard the Second World War as not essentially fighting against the same enemy that they were fighting against in the First World War because of Hitlerism being so special?
Yes. I find that question an interesting one for a curious reason. I was recently in Berlin and I was taken round by a guide who was imbued with the Imperial Berlin, of which so much was still to be seen, or so much could still be evoked. And I realized that my generation, even my generation born too young to be in the First World War, had regarded Imperial Germany as the enemy. It was a Germany which was bent upon conquest, a Germany which was bent upon domination, a Germany which was proud of its victories and determined to build new victories upon them. That was the enemy, and that was the sort of enemy that England feared and fought in the First World War. And I realized that although, of course, I detested as satanic the German regime after 1933, it was still Germany, as powerful, aggressive, dominating, imperial. That was the enemy for me. That still is.